There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast is being brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.
So whenever I'm trying to figure out what exactly is happening in a Supreme Court hearing, I talk to my friend Fane Lozman, having taken two cases to the Supreme Court. He's usually on top of all the big cases. And I was following it, but not with the intensity that he was. I didn't realize that there was a streaming audio, or I would have been listening to it. I knew that in the back of my head, but I guess, you know, so much stuff has been going on lately. But there were some pretty crazy highlights in today's Supreme Court hearing on the Trump immunity case. And the first thing that really, you know, the lawyer that's representing Donald Trump in this case used to be a law clerk for Justice Scalia. Very smart. John Sauer. I don't know what the D stands for. Fane told me, but I don't remember. And we're thinking that this decision probably won't come down until late in June. That's the typical time frame, which means that's not enough time to start the trial for the January 6th trial before the election. So this decision looks like it will impact all of the cases except for the hush money trial that's going on. I say hush money, except for the NDA Michael Cohen the liar trial that's going on in New York City right now. It really doesn't look like it will affect, it can't affect that at all. But there was some serious carrying on in the courtroom today, because the prosecution brought up some text messages between the former editor-in-chief of the National Enquirer, is it Enquirer or Inquirer? It's Enquirer, I think, right? He was texting back and forth with an unknown relative. I mean, I love how they were able to get their hands on all of these text messages. Let me tell you, your stuff's not safe. I don't care what you think. And the text messages were, they were told that they could bring them up, but that they had to redact some of the details in them. And I would imagine that part of that would be the person who is a relative of Dylan Howard, right? Why should they be dragged into this case? So the prosecutor got up, and this guy Bove, Emil Bove, and he began speaking about the text message, and he went, this is a text message between Dylan Howard and the defense team jumped up and started screaming, whoa, 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 because they're not allowed to do that. They couldn't bring his name up. And he goes, oh, sorry, I didn't mean that. I've always said, you know, lawyers know what lines they can't cross. And sometimes they feel it's worth it to cross it because it will color the way the jury thinks. So we'll see how that happens, you know, if that plays out. I find this whole trial just so bizarre to me. We still haven't heard from the judge about the gag order. You know, a gag order where he's allowed to speak about the judge. He's allowed to speak about the prosecution. He's just not allowed to speak about witnesses or family members. It's so confusing and it's so unconstitutional that I give up. But I really have to start the meat of today's show with the movie that I saw last night. And I told everybody yesterday, and a couple of you remembered, that I was going to see this movie, Civil War. And I had a vague idea of what the movie was about. I saw a very small on the internet, on YouTube or something, I saw a trailer, but not a whole length trailer, a small trailer. And I like Kirsten Dunst. I think she's a good actress, and she's not one of these, you know, boilerplate, fashion-y looking women. And she takes some pretty interesting roles. She was very young when she did Interview for a Vampire, and I've seen her in a couple of movies. I like her ability to use her facial expressions without worrying, do I look glamorous? If you understand what I mean. Meryl Streep was great at that, too. They're pretty, but that's not what they're counting on. So I said, I'm going to go see this movie. And I just said it in sort of a casual manner a few days ago, because we had a gift card to the cinema. And then yesterday, just before my show, my husband said, let's go see that movie tonight. I said, okay. You know, and I went online to Fandango and ordered the tickets. And we went to the movie last night at 6:50, walked into the theater, and there were way too many previews, way too many. Like, and they were all apocalyptic, nightmare, horror stuff. You know, the kind of stuff that I can't look at. I have to look away. And so we sat through that, and it just kept going on and on. The movie was supposed to start at 6:50. At 7:10, I start yelling, you know, are we going to see a movie here? You know, like anybody's listening. But I tell you this for a couple of reasons. We were the only people in the theater. There wasn't one other person in this theater. It was a private showing for all intents and purposes. And this is the number one box office hit for 2 weeks now. And we were the only people there. Now, they had two showings of the movie. One was at 7 o'clock, I think, or 7:15 or something, and this one was 6:50. So I'm telling myself that maybe people were going to the later show. I don't know. But that is concerning. David, what's his name? Jerry Seinfeld had an interview earlier this week when he said the movies are dead. Film is over. Nobody goes to the movies. And boy, last night was an example of nobody goes to the movie. As soon as the movie started, I turned to my husband and I said, I don't think I want to stay and see this movie. And not because I wasn't, you know, didn't think it would be a good movie. I like Gardner, the director. I mean, does some crazy stuff. And I liked all the characters almost immediately. I couldn't quite figure out the younger journalist, but, you know, whatever. That movie was so disturbing that last night, it's not that I had nightmares all night. I couldn't get out of the movie in my head all night long. It was like every time I would kind of fall asleep, I'd be in one of the scenes of the movie. Now, that is not a familiar experience to me. I mentioned it to a friend this morning, and she said, oh, yeah, that happens to me when I see certain things. I end up reliving them with myself as a character. And it had never happened to me before, but it did last night. And let me tell you why. Because when I got home from the movie, I just quickly went to my computer to see what was what. And I saw that there was a lot of really rotten behavior going on still at these college campuses. And so I did turn on the television just to get like a quick overview of what was going on. And it looked just like the movie on a smaller scale. Like the movie is what I saw on television on Columbia and University of Texas and all these other campuses on steroids. And what was really concerning to me was this movie will appeal to people on both sides. Because if you're like me and very concerned that government and the bureaucrats in government are running the show and you don't want them to, there was certainly evidence of that. This was a president gone rogue in his third term, which right away tells you it's rogue, and he used the United States military against the citizenry. That happens to be something that concerns me, especially when they basically got rid of all the people who might feel differently and not support a Biden regime, basically got them out of the military, partially with the COVID restrictions and partially with, you know, this concerted effort that Lloyd Austin had of weeding out extremists and all this other stuff, because he assumes that anybody who might have voted for Donald Trump is an extremist.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So for someone like me, that part of the movie really resonated. But for the left, it was fascinating. Do you know who the enemy was in this movie? Who the president was fighting? He was fighting this Western Front, which was comprised of, now listen to this, California and Texas, which had seceded from the Union and were fighting. It was truly a civil war. And then there was some implication that there was a Florida resistance. So now I'm thinking, well, the left is all going to, they're going to love this because it paints the Texas and Florida people in a terrible light, but also California? Like, how does that happen? How do you think that California would secede from the Union when they're basically getting everything they want from Washington? And then some. So that confused me. A lot of the movie confused me, to be perfectly frank. It was visually very concerning. There was only one part where I had to turn away when a journalist got hit by a, you know, machine gun. And, you know, they were trying to stuff his innards. I couldn't look at that for more than 1 second. But for the most part, the violence looked just like what the news looks like. It was exaggerated a little bit, but I'm really concerned. And here's my take on this movie, because I already had a couple of listeners who said, well, should I go see the movie? I don't know how it will affect other people, but I'm going to tell you that this is a movie that seriously looked at what this would look like if we had a civil war in this country today. You know, when I shared that with Fain Lozman on the phone this afternoon, he said to me, Joyce, it'll be an economic civil war. It won't be that. It's the haves against the have-nots. And I said, yeah, but if this is how it looks, if they are literally, you know, if there are tanks going down New York City streets and California streets and Washington, D.C. is, you know, under basically a military coup. And then I wake up to the Supreme Court. And one of the things that was said during the questioning by the justices to the attorneys and the solicitor general, whoever it is that represents the government, was, what about if a president orders a coup? And I went, bingo. That was basically what this movie was about. And the fact that it showed some pretty intense images of American soldiers fighting the resistance, that's what they kept calling it. And I had to stop. I've always thought of the United States military as defending me, as going after bad guys. But this movie implied that the United States military could very easily be used against me, which leads me to the Second Amendment, which the founding fathers were quite clear about. They said a well-armed militia, just in case. And I tell you right up front, the only reason this militia was as successful as it was in the movie, in the end, you know, it's a kind of a terrible ending, is because they were armed. And not just armed a little. I mean, they had machine guns and rocket launchers and things like that. And all I know is, if you're not prepared for some pretty scary stuff to happen after the election this year, then go see this movie. But if you already understand that things could get very, very ugly, regardless of which side wins, then don't see this movie, because it'll cement those views and make you literally sleepless. Because that's the way I would describe what I was last night. It wasn't that I was having nightmares. It was that I couldn't get out of the movie in my head, and therefore I was up and down and up and down and up and down, and it wasn't fun. I wouldn't mind being up and down in some movies, but not this one. So don't forget to download the app, the 850 WFTL app. That way you could participate in all of our contests. You could hear the podcasts and all that good stuff. And if you don't want to do that, go visit our website, 850WFTL.com. Let me take a quick break. I'll be right back. Is that Harvey Weinstein, in a stunning ruling, his rape convictions in New York were vacated by a judge in the New York State Court of Appeals. And part of the opinion says very pointedly that even unpopular defendants are entitled to fair trials. So Alex Berenson pointed out in an article right after that that because Judge Marchand in the Trump trial, maybe better pay attention to this. Because you see, here in this country, we prosecute crimes, not people. That's the fundamental principle of our justice system. It doesn't matter if a defendant, you know, goes to church every Sunday. It doesn't matter if the defendant has an affair every Tuesday. Defendants are accused of committing specific offenses, and prosecutors have to prove their guilt without making the trial a referendum on their character, and definitely not making it a referendum on their political views. So on Thursday, this New York State's top court stood for that principle. And I think Berenson, too, we think this may impact Donald Trump's felony trial in New York. Because it's obvious to me that what the prosecutors are doing openly is trying to make this jury weigh in on whether or not Donald Trump's a nice man. So in a 4-3 decision, the New York State Court of Appeals overturned the 2020 rape convictions of Harvey Weinstein, the movie mogul, who became obviously a very notorious guy in the hashtag Me Too because he had some very aggressive sexual behavior. And in a 40-page opinion, the majority ruled that Weinstein's trial had been tainted because the judge, Justice James M. Burke, who oversaw it, allowed prejudicial testimony that was irrelevant to Weinstein's alleged crimes. The court also found that Judge Burke effectively kept Weinstein from testifying in his own defense by ruling that if he did, prosecutors could question him about irrelevant issues like a fight that he had with his brother. Does that sound familiar to you? You know, is that not why people say Donald Trump can't get on that stand? Because now that they've allowed in the Access Hollywood transcript and, you know, this Stormy Daniels and all this other stuff, if they put Donald Trump on the witness stand and put him under oath, he has to talk about those things. So watching this court, the majority opinion says that courts have to uphold the principles that, let me quote from the opinion. Under our system of justice, the accused has a right to be held to account only for the crime charged, and thus allegations of prior bad acts may not be admitted against them for the sole purpose of establishing their propensity for criminality. It is our solemn duty to diligently guard these rights, regardless of the crime charged, the reputation of the accused, or the pressure to convict. The only evidence against the defendant was the complainant's testimony, and the result of the court's rulings, on the one hand, was to bolster their credibility and diminish the defendant's character, while the threat of a cross-examination highlighting these untested allegations undermined the defendant's right to testify. The remedy for these egregious errors is a new trial. That's relevant to Donald Trump's trials. It is. 34 felony charges of falsifying business records, and they're bringing up affairs, they're bringing up relationships with the Enquirer, all this other stuff. There's a lot of similarities, because both Weinstein and Donald Trump are wildly unpopular in New York, and both of them were accused of sexually aggressive or even predatory behavior. And like Justice Burke, Justice Marchand, who's overseeing the Trump trial, has given the Manhattan prosecutors wide latitude to present evidence of actions that appear at best tangentially related to the crimes that they're alleged to have committed. What does Stormy Daniels herself, what does the conversation in the Access Hollywood tape have to do with whether or not Donald Trump falsified, you know, expenses? And it has nothing to do with it. Nothing. So this is very interesting to me. Manhattan prosecutors may be walking into a trap, and hopefully Trump's attorneys are aware of that, and I'm sure they are. All right, I'll tell you. It just keeps getting more and more interesting. You know, I was having that conversation again today that I have all the time. Like, will I still want to do this radio show this year, next year, the year after? What, you know, when do I stop? And they just don't stop making situations that I need to talk about. That's what it is. Can we just have like a, you know, a couple of weeks, couple of months of peace so that I can, you know, retire and maybe swing in a hammock and avoid listening to news? It's not looking real promising. All right, stay where you are. My good friend, my old friend, Mike Gonzalez is coming on. He's got a new book out with Kate Gorka about next generation Marxism, what it is and how to combat it. And if ever we are seeing an example of it, it's on college campuses. I'll be right back. All right, and welcome back. It's been quite some time since I had an opportunity to talk to my friend Mike Gonzalez. He is the Angelus T. Arredondo Senior Fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. He's a, you know, journalist, and he's written from all over the world, Europe, Asia, and Latin America. How you doing, Mike?
Hey, Joyce. It's been too long.
Way too long. And every time I look at these college campus riots, I think of you. You were predicting this years ago.
Yeah, I've written many books about it. In fact, I just published a new book, Next Gen Marxism, with Catherine Gorka, explaining why we're seeing all of this.
It's frightening. I went to a movie yesterday, Mike, and I don't really go to the theater anymore, but I went to see this movie, Civil War, and during the whole movie, I'm sitting there, I'm looking at this, and it looked like those college campuses on steroids. Like, there is a distinct possibility that there's going to be blood in the streets in November, and I'm really kind of scared.
Well, the problem is that the college presidents, and I'm talking about Manoush Shafiq, Colombia, and the others have not taken control of the situation. In Texas, I just saw one of the campuses where the demonstrators were just arrested and put into paddy wagons and sent away. Mm-hmm. And unless you do that right away, what you do is if you show weakness, then the demonstrations will mushroom. We saw that in the 1960s.
Yes.
We saw that many decades ago, when the administrators panicked and they show cowardice, and then the students realized that they could get everything they demanded, and they changed a lot of things. They changed society, and I think that this is what they want to do now. It's not about Gaza, George.
No.
It's not about the West Bank. They don't know what the West Bank is. It shows in interview after interview. They have no idea where these places are in the world. What they want to do is change American society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're right. Having been a student radical in the 1960s, I have a very distinct memory of how much we were trying to alter the world. It wasn't just college campuses. It wasn't just the war in Vietnam. We wanted to change everything. And unfortunately, you know, I think because I was young and idealistic that I excused some of the most egregious behavior, you know, taking over campuses and, you know, storming lecture halls and freeing animals and stuff from laboratories. But this is more than that. This is people who have been reduced to race, ethnicity, and sexual identity. And that's what your new book talks about. That's what Marxism does.
Yeah, in the very first page of the manifesto, and I've gone back and looked, and it's also in German, because mm-hmm. Marx wrote it in German.
Right.
There you have the words oppressed versus oppressor. All of mm-hmm. all of human interaction is grain of nuance and boiled down to an epic struggle between the oppressed, the people who are subordinate and suffer, and the oppressors, the mm-hmm. evil people who keep them down and make them downtrodden. Mm-hmm. And that is, Marx would say that that the downtrodden, the oppressed, would have to win through a total war. In the case of the bourgeois and the owner of capital and the proletariat, the worker would have to overthrow the bourgeois, kill him, rape his wife, and use great violence to overthrow society. Mm-hmm. And this is really what is going on here. The reason why you see students justifying the perverse actions of the terrorists who invaded Israel and committed atrocities, murdered, massacred 1,200 people, including innocent women and children, in ovens, unspeakable brutality, not seen since the Holocaust. The reason these students are supporting them and not listening to their victims, the women they actually gang raped, it's because they look at the world through this oppressor and oppressed paradigm that is so dehumanizing and so wrong. Mm-hmm. That's all there is, Joyce.
Yeah, and it's frightening to me because I think that a lot of this disruption has to do with the economics of America today. Because if you have, 60, 70, 80% of the wealth being controlled by a very small minority of the people, you set in motion this frustration. And then you've got one party that says, well, don't worry, because we'll pay off your student debts and we'll make sure you get $20 an hour to flip a hamburger. And you develop a voting bloc, or at least a disinterested group in free market. And then you have the other side, which seems oblivious to the fact that, like, maybe we should stop showing the outrageous wealth that these athletes and these musicians and others laud on TikTok and everywhere else. Like, how is somebody who's 18, 19 years old, how are they supposed to feel about that?
But, Joyce, the kids demonstrating, they're super wealthy.
Yeah.
Their parents have sent them. Their parents are paying $90,000 a year.
I sent my daughter to Columbia. I sent my son to Harvard. I sent one to Yale.
Know.
Yeah, I know what it costs, and I know that they're not poor kids.
These are not poor kids. This is the rich, the bicoastal elite rich, the people who are actually, suffering the brunt of Bidenomics. The people
aren't
who
at Columbia.
Are not Columbia. They're not in university at all. If they go to university, they go to state, or they go to community college. Because like me, I had to go to a community college when I was young. Then I went to a proper school.
Yeah.
So me too, I had to get as many credits as I could in Southern Florida before I could go to a college in Boston. So and then I also went to Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
We have inversed the relationship. The class that is revolting is the very rich, the very privileged, the very college accredited, and the people who are resenting all of this, and they should resent it, because it's their society that the rich want to change, are the people who haven't gone to college, who work with their hands, who live in what our elites like to call so derisively flyover country. They're not demonstrating. They have three jobs.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they still believe in the principles of this country. I look at these students. They are clueless. I'll bet there's not a single one on these college campuses and these encampments who could tell me what the three branches of government are. They're not being taught that. They have no respect for a free market economy, even though they've been the beneficiaries of it. So that's our fault. Parents in my age group, my kids are now grown with children of their own, but we did a really lousy job at telling them what a great concept America is and how much they benefited from this incredible country. And boy, the hatred for America is so deep and so profound that why not Marxism?
Yeah, no, it is hatred for America. Mm-hmm. They tell you. Yeah. You know, I've seen them. They say there's a guy. I wrote about him last week. He came out and said, look, man, what we want is to dismantle the United States, to dismantle Western civilization. Why do they hate Israel so much? Because Israel is mini-me America.
That's right.
Israel is just like us. Mm-hmm. They call it, they say, well, it's a white settler state. Guess what they call the United States? The white settler state. So Israel is free, it's democratic, it's capitalist. We're free, we're democratic and capitalist. Israel is a reflection of us, surrounded by atavistic states. Mm-hmm. This is why they hate Israel.
Yeah. And I've read most of your books. I haven't read the new book. But, I think back to things that you were writing 10 years ago and 8 years ago and how it's all come home. And there's this sort of I don't understand why people, instead of concentrating on how they could remedy these things, are obsessed with, four trials going on that nobody makes any, nobody can even make sense of. And this insane, I don't even know how to describe it. We just are detached from the reality. And I don't know how that is improved. I've been on talk radio for this is my 34th year. And when I look at the years and the things, the subjects that I've covered, this is the most dysfunctional, dystopian society I've ever had to talk about.
Well, the good news is, Joyce, that I think the American people have actually are starting to wake up. I think what happened in the riots of 2020 have woken up a lot of Americans who are saying, no, we don't want this to happen. This is exactly what we don't want to happen, and we want to reverse this. So I think that we all have to help them. Mm-hmm. The American people need to be helped by the political class and by the activists so they can fight against this, fight in the sense of a battle of ideas.
Yeah. Well, all I know is, I think it was actually Catherine Gorka, who was the director for civil society at Heritage once upon a time, right?
Yes.
Civil society? Can you explain what that is and when was the last time we had it?
Well, that's what they want to destroy.
Antonio
Gramsci, who is the thinker behind a lot of this, who was an Italian in the 1920s, he said one of the reasons why you couldn't have revolution in the West, in Western Europe and the United States and Canada, was because civil society was too strong. So you had to burrow underneath and destroy civil society from within. And that's what we want to do.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little more about the book, because obviously I have to get it right now.
Well, it's called Next Gen Marxism. Mm-hmm. What it is and how to combat it. It's co-authored by Catherine Gorka and me. Mm-hmm. And what it is, it gives you a rundown of why we're here. Why are we seeing all these things? Why are we seeing all the racial craziness and all the sexual craziness and all the climate craziness and all the Gaza craziness? There's nothing about race or sex. The issue is never the issue. The issue is the revolution. They use these things as pretext to transform society. They want power. The Marxism starts as an economic theory, and then many of the things that Marx said would happen don't happen. And when West European communists tried to overthrow Germany and Italy and establish German and Italian Soviets, they fail. And they figure out, well, you have to get through the culture. Mm. Popular beliefs are also material forces.
Right.
And then it comes to America in the 1960s, and it really flowers here, except what we do is we add race and sex to it and climate and organizing, neighborhood organizing. So it gives you, it really describes how we got here. That's what we call the next-gen Marxism. Mm-hmm. And what are the policy solutions that we have to implement in order to get out of this?
Yeah, because, I was talking earlier this week about, I know what gaslighting is, and they love to use that term. It was out of a movie in the 40s, psychological manipulation, right? But guess what? What we have going on is reverse gaslighting, because now they're trying to convince us that insane things are completely normal, like a boy deciding it's a girl, or the the competition between males and female sports, or if you wear a mask, you're not going to get a respiratory illness, or if you walk 6 feet, and we just seem to like be, I don't understand how a populace which has so many advantages has fallen prey to this. But you know, I'm going to read the book because I do believe that some of these economic theories that spring forth with these cultural shifts that are frightening to me, just frightening.
Well, you know, the movie Gaslight was exactly about that. Remember, the husband mm-hmm. who wanted to do his wife kept flickering the gaslight, mm-hmm. and then his wife would complain about it and said, no, there's nothing happening with the gaslight.
Right.
It's not flickering. Mm-hmm. He was doing it to drive her crazy.
Right. Well, you don't think it drives me crazy when I have a 17-year-old look at me and say there are 30 different genders and that I'm homophobic if I don't agree with that? I mean, I just sit here and I go, wow, are you serious? You want to have a discussion about Transgender Day of Visibility on Easter Sunday? Like, I must be crazy.
You know, one thing that I want to tell you, They say, well, this is not anti-Semitism. You know, this is just but, you know, I actually went back mm-hmm. and read parts of Mein Kampf.
Yeah.
Hitler's Mein Kampf. And he does the same thing.
Hitler
he
Youth.
He describes the Jews as being powerful and oppressor, and the Germans as downtrodden and innocent and pure. It's the same thing, Joyce.
Yeah, and he used young people. It was the Hitler Youth that started the movement. Oh, and now I'm looking at
the student union was incredibly popular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, listen, Mike, we got to keep, I keep praying. At this point, I'm resorting to a tremendous amount of prayer, but I also just try to get the real truth out there. You know, I've been bringing survivors of October 7th to churches in Broward County and to the show.
Good for you. But,
yeah, well, people need to know that this is, you know, I'm looking at these interviews with these students and say, well, that never happened. What do you mean that never happened? They videotaped it and then sent the videotapes to the government and to the families. They're not denying.
I just saw the same thing.
Yeah.
I just saw the same thing on Fox yesterday.
Yeah.
They were interviewing somebody at Grand Central Station, and she was saying, no, that never happened. That was a lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is a common mistake that's being made. So all we do is we try to bring the truth and, you know, keep doing the good work. Tell Catherine as well, just don't give up. I mean, this is a battle for the soul of this country, and this country has been too good to me, too good to us. To walk away and give up so easily.
It's a great
easily.
Country. We need to defend it. Cannot be transformed by these idiots.
Amen. Thank you. Thanks. And we got to talk more often, Mike. It was always a pleasure.
Yes.
All right. You take
Thank
care.
You, Joyce.
Bye-bye now. All right. Well, I love Mike Gore. I've loved Mike from the time I first interviewed him 25 years ago. And, you know, he's just a very, very smart guy. And he saw all this. Look, Robert Bork, the justice that wasn't confirmed for the Supreme Court, he talked about this 30 years ago in Sliding Towards Gomorrah. And people like me said, well, this is very interesting and it's an intellectual exercise. And now I'm living in it. And that's why I say, look, if you think these are conspiracy theories, yeah, that's what they said about Noah until it rained. Don't forget, coming up after me is Eric Erickson, followed by Joe Pags and Lars Larson. Then at 6 o'clock in the morning, Jen and Bill will be back with the South Florida Morning Show. 9 o'clock, Brian Kilmeade. Noon, I believe Dan Bongino said he'll have a crew sitting in for him as he takes care of some family business. But at 3 o'clock, I'll be here because tomorrow at 3 o'clock, you are my family business. Let me take a quick break and come back and finish today's show. So I'm awfully grateful that some of the alumnus from these prestigious Poison Ivy League schools are starting to really speak up. You just had Michael Oren, who at one point was an envoy to Israel, talking about how, you know, he's the former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., not the other way around, but he was a Columbia graduate. And he said that this kind of intolerable, unacceptable, and dangerous behavior that's happening to the Jewish kids on these college campuses, but also across Western society, he says this is Very, very frightening. He agrees with what Mike Gonzalez and I were just talking about. This is anti-establishment masquerading as that, but it's not that. It's hate. And it's really, really getting crazy out there. And you need to be prepared. These are not pro... You know, back in the 60s, I was anti-war. We were protesting against the war. Now, they're protesting for the war. Literally. They think that anything is okay as long as it's being done to Jews or the state of Israel or any part of the West, really. The other story that I'm going to get to tomorrow, I've tried to get to it all week, but it's just so much. You know, you can only cover so many things on a given day. That it is now receiving a lot of attention all over the place is the fact that, you know, my generation, and particularly women in my generation, we really embraced feminism because we were looking for a lot of equality. We wanted equality. We wanted to be able to get into med schools. We wanted to be able to serve in government, all those things. But increasingly, what I'm seeing in my daughter's generation, and my daughter's in her 40s, and in the generation right behind that, those that are in their 30s, what I'm seeing is that feminism has failed them. And it's really, it's another one of those issues where you see a great divide. You can be a faith-driven person or a person who lives according to their Protestant, Catholic, Jewish faiths. But it's this fact that feminism overtook their faith. And literally, the things that they embraced and the ways they tried to live their lives has now left them, and this is the headline that I read today. This will scare you. Feminism has left middle-aged women like me single, childless, and depressed. Great. Not me, but the author, Petronella Wyatt. I'm going to talk about this tomorrow. Anyway, thank you for your time this time. Until next time, my plan is to be back here in front of this microphone at 3 o'clock tomorrow, if it be his will, and he delays his coming. What lies behind us and what lies ahead of us are tiny matters compared to what lies within us. So wherever you are, just be yourself. Everybody else is taken. And then, as always, may God bless you. May God bless Israel. May God bless the United States of America. See you all tomorrow at 3.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast has been brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.